Welcome, everybody. This is Derek Bodner here with the Sixers Beat, or at least what I'll call the Sixers Beat. It's not necessarily the format that you're used to, which is me and my co-host, Rich Hoffman. But Rich and I have had a little bit of a struggle getting our schedules to align, and that'll happen at times as we're both busy people. But in the meantime, I really want to, you know, try to talk about the Sixers at least once a week. I get a lot of questions through Twitter for the mailbag, and trying to keep that column, at a readable format where it's not too long. I'm not able to address all these questions, so I'm gonna try to talk, do a podcast at least once a week. I will, make sure that I label each podcast with who's on it, so that you will not be tricked into listening to just me. And if you find this boring, you can certainly, I don't begrudge you for not listening again in the future. This is an 0-14 team. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably a diehard Sixers fan, and I appreciate that. And I thank that. I thank you for reading. I thank you for following me on Twitter. And I thank you for listening to the podcast whenever you do. But we're going to try this format. We're going to, I'm going to try to keep this relatively short because it is one person. I don't want to have one person drone on about an 0-14 team. But we're going to try to do this just to get some thoughts out that I have about the team. Moving on to the team, and it seems like there's been a lot of, general anxiety about the team recently, both nationally and locally. And it really started probably about the Dallas game, when they had those back-to-back games where they had the Raptors and then Dallas, and they got blown out in both of them. Before that, they were really playing some competitive basketball, some entertaining basketball with Nerlens Noel and KJ McDaniels blocking shots and getting out in transition and just playing an entertaining brand of basketball that I think, if we have to suffer through this losing season, that I think people were relatively happy about. But ever since that game, there's been a sentiment that's kind of shifted. And those were two awful matchups for the Sixers, right? You had Toronto and Dallas, both really, really good at taking care of the basketball. And with how dependent the Sixers are in getting out in transition to generate offense, getting their defense set after scoring, how much they turn the ball over in the half court, which leads to transition opportunities for the opponent, they really need to get out there, force turnovers and get out on the break, and they weren't able to do that in those games, and they're just not going to be competitive in very many of those games. But I think that those two games have kind of shifted the perception of this team quite a bit, and perception is really interesting. There's obviously a lot of people talking about how this is an embarrassment, this is a disgrace, there's no reason they should be tanking a second year, how can they do this, things of that sort. And it's interesting to me how that that perception would have changed if Joel Embiid had been able to play. And I think there's no doubt that, Joel Embiid, if healthy, they still would have selected him. I think those people who suggest that, the Sixers selected Joel Embiid so they could tank this season are ridiculous. The whole point of tanking is to get a high draft pick, to get in the position to draft a superstar player. If you're in that position already, which the third pick of the draft you are, then your priority is getting a potential franchise player. It's not about setting up the next year's tank, where there may or may not be a useful player in that mix. So the Sixers did not draft Joel Embiid to tank. They drafted Joel Embiid because they thought he was the best person there. They just weren't scared off by his injury. So getting that out of the way, I think it's interesting if Joel Embiid were playing, if you were seeing that potential franchise player, if maybe they'd gotten another shooter or two to surround Joel Embiid so that you could really play him as a post presence. And if you weren't winning games, even if you were 0-14, if you saw that potential superstar, whether or not people would still be up in arms, whether it would be how can you do this, we're 0-14, or whether it would be, man, you got a guy that we think in 3 years can really dominate in this league, would Sam Hinkie be getting a lot more leeway, a lot more benefit of the doubt from Sixers fans and national media? I think there's almost no question that they would. What he was doing was right when Joel Embiid was healthy, then it's still right now. And I'm very excited about the future. I'm very excited about Joel Embiid. But I think we need to, keep in mind that this looks bad right now because Joel Embiid is not playing. Kind of a byproduct of the general anxiety about the team is hate towards Joshua Harris. And I think a lot of this comes in because they're so far under the salary cap. They're so far under the salary cap floor. To be honest, I think I'm the only one that's around the team on a regular basis, that's credentialed, that has full season credentials with the team, that's written about you know, the salary cap floor, how they're potentially circumventing it, how they're using, you know, the loophole that they changed in 2011 about how it's determined based on, you know, the team salary at the end of the year and the full season salary of the players on the roster rather than the actual payroll and what they've spent, about how they're using that as a potential loophole to save money. I think I'm the only one who's written about that. I think I'm the only one who's really written about Jason Richardson and whether or not, you know, he's on the roster because he's potentially a savings because of a payout from the insurance company, which they wouldn't get if they released him. So I certainly don't want to say that, you know, Joshua Harris isn't making decisions to make money. But I think there's this thought that Sixers are so far under the salary cap floor because Joshua Harris wants to maximize his profits because this is all about bleeding, you know, the fans dry, about being able to generate as much revenue, as much profit as possible. And I just don't think that's the case. You know, this is a guy worth $2.5 billion who's making money hands over fist because of the increasing valuation of all NBA teams, you know, and because the changing nature of the CBA, the changing national TV deal. He's going to make a ton of money whenever it is he decides to sell this franchise, whenever he feels like he's done owning the team, whether it's out of competitive reasons, whether he's doing it because he wants the perks of being an NBA owner, whether he's doing it just to flip it in 10 years for a profit, which I don't think is necessarily, you know, the worst thing in the world, as long as it doesn't, you know, drive basketball decisions. I truthfully believe that the Sixers right now are so far under the salary cap because Sam Hinkie wants that flexibility, because he wants to be able to make the Andrei Kirilenko and Sergei Karasev deal if it comes up, because, you know, he wants to be flexible at the deadline so that if somebody wants to dump a contract and give us a free draft pick, that he's able to do that. And there's almost no doubt in my mind that this is what's really driving it. And again, might, if they're at the trade deadline, might they acquire some salary to hit the floor and use that loophole? Yes, I think that's definitely a possibility. I think it's fair to question whether or not, you know, Joshua Harris goes, you know, Sam, if you want to use this plan and have no fan interest and have our attendance drop to rock bottom, one of the conditions of doing that is that there's this loophole with Jason Richardson, keep him on the contract, you know, but otherwise do what you want to do. I think that's fair to suggest that there's a possibility that is happening. But I think that, you know, I think Sam Hinkie, he wants to develop Joel Embiid, let him prove that he's a force in this league. He wants to develop Michael Carter-Williams, and maybe if he improves, you know, quite a bit, he can prove that he's relevant in his team. And then he wants to go out there in free agency when these guys have asserted themselves and try to use that to acquire a third superstar or a third star or whatever you want to label them as, a third very good player. Similar to what Houston was doing, keeping their cap as flexible as possible so that they can go get somebody to compliment Dwight Howard and James Harden. You know, I think Sam Hinkie was trying to do something similar to that. And I think suggesting otherwise, there's a lot of bitterness, whether or not it's because you know, you don't see the value in this plan, you think it's a good disgrace, you don't like how Joshua Harris made his fortune. But I think there's a lot of bitterness in that revolving. I think it kind of drives a lot of the narrative and loses the benefit of the doubt for these guys. A lot of people don't like Sam Hinkie for what they perceive to be a more of a numbers guy, for what they don't see as a basketball guy, which I think is ridiculous. You know, Sam Hinkie he's going to the coaches versus cancer, not, you know, because he wants to work on his spreadsheet on his tablet while sitting in the stands, but because he wants to scout. He's going to Serbia because he's scouting. So I think Sam Hinkie kind of gets undersold as a basketball guy, but there's that perception out there. And again, perception tends to drive a lot of reality. But, you know, I think all that drives narrative, and I don't think that's really going to change until the Sixers are not just getting better, not 30 wins, not 35 wins, not 40 wins, but I think they really have to be winning 50 games, winning the division, challenging for the conference, challenging for an NBA championship. It's probably not going to be until then that really changes. I think a really good example of this, and again, it's whether this plan is being carried out this way because of Joshua Harris or whether it's because of Sam Hinkie, is the Jeremy Lin trade rumors over the summer. I have connections to both teams and can say with a reasonable degree of certainty that, you know, they were in pretty good deep talks about Jeremy Lin. From what I understand, that what really, you know, prevented that deal from happening was that the Lakers were willing to take less on. They were willing to take back less willing to get less of an asset in order to take back Jeremy Lin's contract. So Jeremy Lin, he's got an interesting contract in that his cap hit is only $8.3 million, but the team has to pay out $14 million to him, $14.9 million to him. So for a team like the Sixers who, you know, there's that they either have to get the salary cap floor one way or another. Either they add the salary or they pay it out to the players. For a team that has to get to that salary cap floor, his actual cost being more than his cap hit is very bad for an owner who is allegedly trying to make as much money as possible, squeeze out every dime that he can. So the fact that they were willing to do this in the offseason, but that it came down to, you know, draft pick compensation not being enough, to me suggests that it wasn't enough for the flexibility that they were willing to take on, not that it wasn't enough for the contract that they were willing to take on. Because overall, the earning potential from Joshua Harris's mind of a mid-first-round pick rather than the late first-round pick the Lakers ended up getting is negligible. That's not going to impact his bottom line. What it will impact is Sam Hinkie and his flexibility under the salary cap. So I think that decision to not make that Jeremy Lin trade because the Rockets weren't offering enough in terms of compensation really came down to not offering enough from a basketball standpoint, not from a business standpoint. So I think that's a pretty good example of the distinction between whether or not the Sixers aren't spending because Joshua Harris wants to make money or whether the Sixers aren't spending because Sam Hinkie wants to preserve as much flexibility as possible. And, that doesn't necessarily mean that the exact way that Sam Hinkie is approaching this is a correct way. I think there's some legitimate question that maybe they've gone too far, not because I think the blowout losses are ruining the culture or whether I think it's a disgrace or whether they owe it to, anyone else really, but whether or not this is a situation where Michael Carter-Williams, where Nerlens Noel, well, all those guys can develop. And I think that, if you're looking at the priorities of this year, whether or not Jakarr Sampson is able to take the Lorenzo Brown Express down to Delaware enough times where in 5 years he's a legitimate NBA, 10th man, or whether or not Robert Covington can end up being a cheap, third or fourth big off the bench, or whether or not, Drew Gordon ends up being a rotation player. All that is so minor in the grand scope of things that the most important part of this season is whether or not you're able to develop and evaluate Michael Carter-Williams and Nerlens Noel, whether you can, when the Sixers get Joel Embiid back, whether when they draft, go into the 2015 draft, whether you know what Michael Carter-Williams is, what you need around him, whether he can fit with these guys that you're drafting and make decisions based off of that. And I think because of that, some of the lack of talent on his team, particularly for Michael Carter-Williams, who, we're rating as much his decision-making because he's a point guard as we are his physical skills. Because of that, I think it's really hard to rate Michael Carter-Williams and his progress. And it's one thing to take a look at his shooting, whether he's improving as a shooter off the pick and roll, whether he's improving in catch and shoot situations. Those are all things that I think that you can still relatively well measure. And obviously the amount of space he gets because of his teammates is going to impact that, but you at least get an idea of that. But it's really his decision-making, his shot selection, his decisions passing the ball. If he tries to really do too much because of the overall lack of talent level, I think it's going to be hard to really, really evaluate his progress. And I think that's a legitimate concern. I think that's partly a byproduct of this overall plan, but I think it could be lessened by the execution of the plan. And I think that those questioning that more so than the culture, more so, I think my take on culture is always that culture impacts losing more than losing impacts culture. And by that, I mean that players who have a good mindset, who are mentally tough, who, have developed a good culture and good habits before getting here, who are willing to listen to coaches, who have a coach who has good attention to detail, they can get through a hard losing period like this. So whether or not, Michael Carter-Williams can, whether or not this insidious culture that the Sixers allegedly have is going to hurt Michael Carter-Williams, that I'm not as concerned about, because I think we do a very poor job of, measuring those aspects, measuring those psychological aspects. I think we all think we're better at it than we are, that we know more than we do. And I think that they can overcome that. But it's whether or not we can measure his progress in terms of basketball skill that I have the most questions about. I think that's fair. But, you know, overall, some of the criticisms about the team, the narratives about the team, I think they're incredibly overblown. But ultimately, until they win, you're going to have these. Moving on to, the starting lineup, that's been another point of contention for many Sixers fans, specifically Sixers fans who are not completely against the way that they're going about building this team, but who are watching the games, who do care, who do think that there are players here worth developing. And, you know, there are a couple of things that they disagree with. First, KJ McDaniels, and then going on to Tony Roten and Michael Carter-Williams, whether or not they fit. Luke Bamute's overall playing time. You know, I think specifically, we'll start off with KJ, because I think this is another thing that's getting blown out of proportion quite a bit. And it kind of came to a head when he played 11 minutes the other night, and his mom went off on Twitter. And his mom has been critical of pretty much every organization he's ever played for. So I think you have to kind of, you know, realize that she is KJ's biggest fan, and she's probably always going to be critical, as, at least as long as she's on social media. And it seems like she actually did delete her Twitter account this time. You know, but KJ right now, he's getting 22.7 minutes per night. He's, I believe it's eighth among rookies in playing time. He just played 27 minutes against Portland. He played 29 against the Knicks. He's getting time. And you see a lot about, well, how's he supposed to develop when he's playing, you know, behind Luke Bamute? I think a lot of times we oversimplify player development as being as simple as getting him as much time as possible. And I don't think that's always the case. And I think if Brett Brown right now, he's really, I think one of the main things that he's getting on KJ for is his defensive rotations. The recognition isn't quite there yet. The knowledge of NBA offense isn't there yet. And I don't think that, you know, playing 27 minutes rather than 23 minutes is having as much impact as many people think. I think KJ has a lot of talent. Obviously, he's a far better offensive player than Luke Bamute. You know, I think the Sixers have a 95.3 offensive rating with KJ on the court, 84.6 with Luke. He's a phenomenal one-on-one defender. I looked it up. He's holding the offensive player to 2.2% less field goal percentage than he's averaging on the season. Whereas Luke, I think, is like 6% higher than their averages. And he obviously has a ton of team defensive ability. Just looking at his block shots, he's blocking over a shot a game from the wing in only 22 minutes a night. It's absolutely absurd. But I do think that there are some times where his defensive rotations are either slow or flat out wrong. And I think that, you know, I looked at one of the areas I looked at to try to quantify that was corner threes. When KJ's on the court, other teams are shooting 42.9% on corner threes, whereas they're shooting 35.6% when he's not on the court. And, you know, this is all on low sample size, but I think it's indicative that, you know, his rotations, he's missing his rotations a little bit. And the one area where he's not holding players to below their season field goal percentage is from behind the three-point line. And I think, you know, you don't want to make too much out of these numbers because, like I said, they are low sample size. But I think it's backing up what I've seen, and it's backing up kind of what I've gotten from Brett Brown when we've talked to him about it. And there's a learning curve, and it would be a travesty if right now KJ was getting 5 to 10 minutes a night on this team with how important he is for the future. But the fact that he's playing consistent minutes, he's really only had two games where he hasn't gotten meaningful minutes, and he's getting quality minutes too. You know, he's getting extended runs. And I think he needs to realize that he can develop. I think he needs to realize that this is a good place for him to get playing time, to get consistent playing time, to develop, and to, quite frankly, make a whole lot of money this offseason. So he needs to, while I can understand being frustrated at 11 minutes when maybe he didn't know why he got his minutes cut, he needs to realize that he's in a really good opportunity here. And I think in a couple of months, we won't really be talking about this much. I think as the season goes on, you're going to see that 22, 23 minutes become more consistent 27 to 30 minutes per night. And I think this, you know, we're going to look back on this, and it's, you know, this is 14 games into his rookie season. His development is not determined based on whether he's playing 25 or 30 minutes right now. There's a lot of basketball left for him to be played. There's a lot of time for him to prove to Brett that he's grasping team defensive concepts. And, you know, it's not like he has a great player in front of him. But I think that our frustrations with Luke Bamute as an offensive player and how offensively inept he is have kind of clouded our judgment, not on whether or not KJ should be getting more time, because I think it's pretty obvious that, at least in my world, I would prefer him getting, it, basically if you flip-flop those numbers, KJ getting, you know, 27, 28 minutes a night and Luke getting 22 or 23, I think that would be preferable. But I think we're overstating how much that, you know, that playing time is right now hindering his development. And I don't think it's really hindering his development at all. I've seen people say, how can he develop playing behind Luke? He's still getting consistent minutes, and he's still getting time with Michael Carter-Williams, with Nerlens Noel, with the mainstays of this team. So I think we all need to pump the brakes just a little bit on the travesty that is KJ McDaniel's playing time. Now, the starting lineup that we currently have, Michael Carter-Williams, Tony Roten, Luke Bamute, Henry Sims, and Nerlens Noel, I think is an absolute abomination. And I think I know what Brett Brown's trying to do. I think he wants two guys in Luke Bamute and Henry Sims who he has confidence in being in the right places, who he can try to run a somewhat structured offense because he knows that they're going to be there, who he can try to implement defensive concepts because he has confidence in their rotations, at least in Luke Bamute's case. I think that's why he's giving them some playing time because you know he wants that structure in there for Michael Carter-Williams. The problem is this is the worst shooting lineup I've ever seen in my life. I ran the stats. When that lineup is on the court, they're shooting a combined 9.1% from three-point range, which is just an absolute abomination. The ball movement's awful. Only 44% of their field goals are assisted, whereas 59.3% are assisted on the season for the Sixers. They're not moving the ball. They have no floor spacing. They're not really running an offense. So I think I think as he gets a little, as Brett Brown gets a little bit more comfortable with KJ McDaniels, with his ability to be in the right place and do the right things at the right time, and I think that will come with experience both on the practice court and on the NBA court. I think this will resolve itself. I would be very surprised if in February we're still talking about Luke Bamute getting more minutes than KJ McDaniels. So I think we all need to have just a little bit of patience. I think it will work out in the end. You know, I think there's a lot of people right now who are speculating that it might be contract related, you know, because if KJ McDaniels ends the season playing 25 minutes per night instead of 30 minutes per night, nobody's going to offer him a contract. That's ridiculous. Calm down a little bit. We all like conspiracy theories. But KJ McDaniels right now is not playing because they think KJ McDaniels is only playing 23 minutes per night right now because, you know, they think that this might be best for his development or best for the development of the other players. And whether or not that's the case, I do think it's temporary. I think one other thing to realize, there is more to player development than playing time. I think playing time is one of the few pieces of leverages that coaches have over players. And not so much that KJ isn't listening, although I think there's some things that Brett Brown is obviously frustrated with, and I think those are defensive rotations. But I think that, you know, you can use minutes as a reward. You can use minutes as motivation. And I think there might be some of that going on right now. I think they want to, you know, bring KJ along, not slowly, because, again, he's getting a lot of minutes for a rookie, especially a second-round rookie. But I think they don't want to make everything too fast. I think they want to concentrate on one or two simple things, have KJ improve on that, show improvement in that, and then move forward and take on a bigger responsibility. So I think we all just need to slow down a little bit. Like I said, I think our frustrations with the offensive ineptitude of Luke Bamute is making us overstate how much of a detriment this is towards KJ's development. Going on to the rest of the starting lineup, you know, like I said, 9.1% from three-point range, not really getting much assists. Brett Brown talked today how he doesn't know if starting Michael Carter-Williams and Tony Roten together is going to work, whether it's a good matchup. And I wrote about this a number of times now, but you know, I think obviously you need more shooters around Michael Carter-Williams. I don't think there's any question about that. And ever since starting off hot from downtown, Tony was shooting something like 40% through five games. He's really cooled off. I think he's shooting about 21% since then. His shooting, which Brett Brown at practice the other day called, you know, potentially unsustainable at the beginning of the year, has come back down to earth, and because of that, they've struggled quite a bit. And if Tony and Michael are not going to be much better shooters, then I don't think that pair can work. But by the same token, when Tony's not out there, I think that Michael Carter-Williams is pressing a little bit too much. You know, I think he feels that he needs to create a lot, because quite frankly, he does. And I think, you know, that that's causing him to take some bad shots, force some things that he might not be good for either the team right now or for, the, you know, his long-term, the role that he's going to play long-term. And I think that's, you know, like I said, that's my biggest concern right now in terms of his development. That he's either going to, you know, I think some players can develop bad habits, but I think some players don't. I think we saw it with Andre Iguodala when he was here. He shot a lot of pull-up jump shots because he was trying to do too much. But then he went to Denver, he went to Golden State, and he took those completely out of his arsenal. So hopefully, my hope is that when we do get legitimate NBA talent around Michael Carter-Williams, that some of these issues are going to go away. But by the same token, it's really hard to measure progress, and that's my biggest concern. You know, beyond that, we've had Brandon Davies start a couple times with New Orleans Noel. Whether or not, you know, Brett Brown has expressed some frustration with New Orleans' ability to learn the four defensively. You know, and most of that seems to be coming from transition defense. New Orleans not finding the shooter, not picking up his man, instead doing what he's always done his whole life, running to the rim and trying to protect that. So, you know, I think that combination, I think right now Brett has settled on New Orleans and Henry Simmons playing together, but I think that could change. And I think it's, I don't think it's an optimal pairing, you know, especially with the way that Henry struggles defending the pick and roll, but I think it's what we will see now. You know, I think if it changes, it'll be that two and that three position, whether or not KJ can eventually, overtake, Luke Bamute is a starter, whether or not Hollis Thompson can make another appearance as a starter. And Hollis is the type of guy who conceptually makes a lot of sense to play next to Michael Carter-Williams with, you know, he shot 44% at Georgetown over his college career. He shot 40% as an NBA rookie. But I think, you know, he doesn't quite have a quick enough trigger. He's a little hesitant shooting the ball. And I think that maybe he doesn't open up as much floor space as you would hope. But I think that's the other area where you could really see some change. You know, but they really need Michael Carter-Williams to start playing better. And Doug has blamed part of that on his conditioning. The other night he asked him, Michael Carter-Williams asked whether he could come out after 4 minutes into the game, which took Brett Brown by surprise. But I think it's pretty clear that Michael Carter-Williams is not in NBA game shape, that it's going to take him a little time to get there with, you know, having rehabbed that injury. So I think that we could, you know, there could be some growing pains, and I hope that part of that right now is just that growing pains, getting back into NBA shape, getting accustomed to his teammates. But certainly Michael Carter-Williams not playing the kind of basketball that you would hope for, either on the defensive end, which quite frankly I think his effort has been inconsistent would probably be the nice way to say it. I think he hasn't gotten back in transition. I think he's been lost off the ball. I think there have been a lot of problems with Michael Carter-Williams defensively so far. And his shot selection has not been good enough for what you want your point guard to be. Even with this wretched offensive lineup, I think he's made a lot of bad decisions. And quite frankly, the offense is better when he's not been on the court. And I think part of that is because Tony Roten's skill set as a scorer, as a guy who can attack the paint, is more fit for being on a team that has no offensive options around him than Michael Carter-Williams is. And if you ask Michael Carter-Williams to play that style of basketball, he's not going to be anything approaching efficient doing so. And I think that's, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because there just aren't all that many good options for Brett Brown right now on his roster. You might get marginal improvements by playing KJ with Michael Moore. You might get marginal improvements by playing Hollis with Michael Moore. But I think, you know, I think they're all going to be flawed. So it'll be interesting to see how that is. All right, I'm going to wrap this up. I don't want to have these go too long. And you know, hopefully next week we'll have Rich Hoffman back. We'll have some back and forth there and have a more normal Sixers beat. But thank you once again for listening, and take care.